Please welcome to the stage Andrew James and Joshua Legarry. Maybe we can bring up a little house light so I can see anyone. We are ready to take your questions, but actually before questions, maybe, I think you have a couple other people to introduce, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. We have some, anyone on the crew that's here, if you wouldn't mind coming up, you're welcome on stage.
For sure.
Yeah. Come on down.
We've got our composer, Chris Oran, here, our music executive producer, Rachel May-Legarry. Executive producer Jolyn Schleifarth, co-producer Xavier Gutierrez, co-producer William Rowan, and producer Amber Bollinger. We also have two of the cast members, if you guys want to come up. Philip Gordon, the funny professor. And Robert Perry, who is one of the things like Steelers.
Steve Austin, one of our executive producers, is here in the audience. So,
thanks,
Steve. So I guess we'll just. If you have any questions, or
who's got a question?
Yes, you, sir.
I'm curious about why the Mormons would choose to watch those kind of films rather than just use self censorship, or you know the way books are banned. Don't read that book. Just don't read it.
That's a very good question. The question was, why would this LDS audience, Mormon audience, choose to watch these R-rated films instead of just avoid them and go after clean entertainment? And I think that's a very nuanced discussion, but I think a quick answer to that is that, you know, they, like Josh said in one of our articles, that they want to be part of the cultural zeitgeist. They want to take part in these big films. They want to see The Matrix because everyone's talking about it. They want to see Kill Bill because everyone's talking about it. So they want to kind of fit in and be perceived as normal, and I think that's one way they can do it.
I think Mormons do consider themselves as just normal people with, you know, this certain set of rules that they follow in their lives, and they don't want to be outside of the norm. And the other thing, the argument that's made by the Clean Flicks president is, you know, some of those family movies just aren't enjoyable for adult entertainment. He brings up the Charlotte's Web example, you know, and while, you know, those movies are clean, they're not necessarily interesting to him. So that guy actually made an interesting point. He was in Vietnam, and he was a helicopter pilot, and he never watched Black Hawk Down, and it wasn't until he could get the film edited that he would watch Black Hawk Down, even though he, you know, witnessed a lot of this stuff himself. So, yeah.
I want to draw Robert into this conversation. Robert, you're a part of this world. You're a player in the film. What did you think of the way the film portrayed the story?
The film was great. I love you know, the build-up, and I basically got involved initially because I wanted to see the story come out as well. I was there's probably could be a Clean Flicks part two because there's more. But it, you know, being in a trying to do something you feel is right and helping friends and neighbors and things like that, it was very rewarding. But you know, I felt like, as I said in the movie, you can't break the law and consider yourself a moral person and try to live some higher law in part of your life and not other parts. It's all or none for me.
Phil, let me ask you a similar question. When you watch the movie, what are the things you take away from it?
Well, you know, I live there. And so and it was a big shock for me when I moved to Utah in 1999. I got a job there, and I didn't know what a Mormon was. You know, I heard of them, and then I heard some stories, but I didn't believe them. And it was difficult for me, actually, because I'm a media studies professor, and I love pop culture. And the first time I tried to show a movie in my class, first of all, I gave this same little statement that I always give at all the other universities I ever taught at, which is that if you don't want to watch this movie, you don't have to. You could just leave. And I never had anyone actually take me up on it before. But at my school, that first time, like half the class left, and I started playing the movie, and as it was playing, the other half left. And pretty soon, it was just me and Josh watching the movie together. I'm like, what happened? And then we started talking about it. And so I just have had this, you know, sort of years-long struggle with myself trying to adapt to that culture and living as a sort of stranger in a strange land. And I'm not sure if I answered the question or not, but watching the movie, I don't know. It's hard for me to live there, to tell you the truth. I mean, it helps me to watch the movie because it helps me process it and it makes it all real. But it's a constant challenge, and every day I walk into the classroom there and there's that negotiation and I have to start fresh and I have to try and have a good attitude toward them. And I try and respect the perspective that they're coming from. You know, like Perry, Robert, they're good people trying to do good things. I think they're just misguided. And I hope that this movie will help shed some light on their thinking and their theories of communication. And the truth is, things are changing there. The students are different there now than they were even a few years ago. And I hope that this movie will help that process of self-reflection.
Let's take another question. Okay, you in the front.
Considering that studios edit their own films for full-frame DVDs, was there ever talk of the Hollywood studios getting involved with them, making the edited videos for that specific market, and making the money themselves rather than delegating it to a creator?
Could people hear that question on top?
Yeah.
Good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, the question was, have the directors, the studios thought about editing their own films and capitalizing on the market? And apparently, yes, the answer is yes. What we've heard is that, you know, several members of the DGA, including Steven Soderbergh, I don't know if that's for a fact, but they talked about it and said, yeah, we will edit our own films and do it ourselves and not let someone else do it and release those films, but the studios kind of said no. Because we all know the studios own the films, not the directors. So we've heard that, but can't really verify it.
Yeah, she was just asking about what appealed to us about the topic. Both of us lived in Utah when we started the film, and we were just aware of Clean Flicks just as anyone else there would be. And right around the time the legal troubles started, we were both of us kind of became separately interested in the idea of doing a documentary and telling this kind of Get David and Goliath portion of the film with these huge Hollywood studios going after these two guys in Pleasant Grove, Utah. And that we thought, That story and the idea just that people are editing movies in general would be interesting to a wider audience. The first day that we went to film, we met Daniel Thompson, and he informed us that all of these guys were going to stay in business. You see that clip in the film. And that was when we realized this is a lot bigger than we had anticipated. And so what went from being what was going to be a small little kind of historical document turned into being 2 years of following this guy around and seeing.
Yeah, and to add to that, Xavier, red shirt over there, he brought Josh and I together. He sort of had the idea to do this documentary, and like Josh said, we were kind of thinking about it separately, and he knew both of us and kind of brought us together.
We didn't know each other when we started the film. We met on a couple days before the first day of production and got to know each other during the course of shooting the film, so that's a challenge in and of itself, but yeah.
Rewarding. Rewarding challenge.
Yes, up there. I'm a lawyer, and I watch this thing, and I say, where is Daniel's lawyer, and why is he talking to you?
That's good question for Daniel, I guess. But, you know, Daniel is actually a pretty decent guy underneath all of this stuff. And we met him, like you said, on the first day of filming. We didn't even know him. He signed the release form before we shot a single frame of the film. And things just kind of went from there, you know. And he means well in some respects. I don't want to sit here and diss on Daniel. He's like any of us. He's an imperfect being. And anyway, so
I can you this sweet for just one second. I have a slightly different point of view on it, but Daniel likes attention, and I think you can see from the film that he likes being in front of the camera, and so he was calling us and asking him to come film when things would happen at his store and say, hey, the news is going to be here, you guys should come over, you know, so he was helpful in that way. He really liked the attention, and so when his legal troubles hit, you know, our promise to him was, we'll let you tell your side of the story, because the media hadn't ever allowed him to be interviewed. He'd never been able to share his feelings on it. So we said, if you let us film you through this process, we'll let you tell your side of the story as well. So hopefully we did allow him to do that.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that begs the question, has Daniel seen the film, and what does he think?
I was just going to say, we were editing the film right up until the moment that it played, and we haven't had a chance to screen the film. This is the first time Robert's seen the film, the first time Phil has seen the final film. He's seen a rough cut, and Daniel has not yet seen the film. We are going to screen it for him when we return from Toronto, but we just hadn't had the opportunity.
I have a question about your guys' opinions as filmmakers. You guys do a nice job painting kind of a sympathetic portrait of what the market is here and who wants to see these kinds of videos, but what would you guys think if a service that you didn't control had taken your movie and cut out all the parts they didn't like?
I mean, I'd absolutely be upset about it. I can't speak for Josh. I'll let him answer after this. I fall on the side of, you know, if they're censoring, you know, copyrighted pieces of art that don't belong to them and making a buck off of it, and I kind of feel like that's morally wrong, personally.
This is an issue that we're going to have to tackle a lot more in the future with the digital age, and, you know, with there was a film, Rip, a Remix Manifesto, that dealt with this in music, and I think the film industry is going to have to wake up to the fact that people are going to be doing what they want with their movies, and so there has to be some kind of relationship between those two communities. Both of us are against censorship, blanketly. I don't think that's a question. But I do see the perspective of people that don't necessarily want, and I think doing the film has given us a more nuanced understanding of that issue, that we understand the point of view of people that don't necessarily want to watch those things. The fact that they're doing it illegally makes the conversation over in that sense.
Very bad. What can you tell us about what's happened in the last 6 or 9 months with Daniel? You saw him last in California.
Daniel went to jail. You may have seen at the end of the film, he served 47 days of his sentence before he was released on house arrest. His house arrest is now complete, and he's debating whether or not he's going to stay in Utah. He had said to us, and it's in the film, that he was going to stay in Utah. He's expressed a little fear about the release of the film and thinks that he may want to move somewhere else. We're not sure exactly what's going to happen with him. He started a new business. It has nothing to do with edited movies. That's just kind of where he's at. We haven't been that much in touch with him because we've been editing the movie and he's been in jail, so.
I'm just wondering if you think that
I mean, I think it's understandable that people are worried about protecting their children or not being offended by the material they watch. And I think this goes back to the first question that we received about just avoiding the material if you're offended by it. And I don't think any of us up here would have a problem with that at all. You know, and so I think where the danger comes in is when you have this sort of culture that is constantly censoring, not just their films, but themselves and all these kind of things, and I think Daniel personifies that. I don't think Daniel overshadows those themes. I think he helps tie the film together in that way. And I think what he's doing is in a way related to the editing of the films.
Phil kind of points out that Daniel is a symbol of what can go wrong in that culture. And so I think that's, to me, that's the role that Daniel plays in the film, is what can go wrong if we're living in these kinds of circumstances.
Time for one more question. Who's got? Yes, you, sir.
Yeah. Was there any particular reason why you kept showing a close-up of Daniel's mouth?
No. We should. That's an interesting question. It's just highlighting certain things that he's saying, and we actually had two interview angles on all of our interviews, but then just for simplicity's sake, we decided to only leave that on Daniel so that it maybe draws a little more attention to him through the first half of the film. It was a difficult thing in the course of making the film to know how to transition from the clean flick story to Daniel's story, and so that was the biggest struggle we've had in the editing process. And all along is making those two stories work together. So we were trying to find things to make Daniel stand out in the first half of the film so that he wasn't a stranger by the second half of the film. And so that was one of the techniques we
used. You're the first audience ever to see Clean Flicks. There's two more screenings left at the festival, so please tell your friends. You vote on your ballots, and thank you to Andrew and Joshua.